Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, a story written by T.J. LeHoroux and posted on March 13th. Hamada pumps Guantanamo Bay deportations that aren't happening anymore. Based on GOP Representative Abe Hamada's appearance on a far-right, third-rate streaming and cable channel, you'd think Guantanamo Bay is quickly filling up with dangerous, undocumented immigrants. This administration is just getting started down in Guantanamo Bay, Hamada tweeted Wednesday, linking to an interview with Real America's Voice. The goal is to ramp up capacity to 30,000 illegal immigrants and ensure that America is protected while these criminals are quickly processed and deported back home. If by just getting started, Hamada really meant winding down completely, he'd be exactly right. 5 hours before Hamada's tweet about the supposedly burgeoning effort to hold undocumented immigrants at the infamous military base, which was previously used to hold suspected terrorists, Fox News reported that no migrants were being held there anymore and that no more are expected to arrive. All 40 migrants held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have been sent back to the United States and are now being held in Louisiana, according to two U.S. defense officials. Fox News Pentagon reporter Liz Fryden tweeted, "There are currently no migrants being held at Gitmo, and no flight scheduled to arrive with more migrants." Hamada's spokesperson, Lori Honeycutt, has not responded to questions about Hamada's visit to the Cuba set base, though a news story from the site Cactus Politics, which Hamada promoted in a tweet Thursday morning, a day after the Fox News report that no migrants remained there, says the visit occurred in the first week of March. Hamada's description of the setup at Guantanamo Bay doesn't appear to be inaccurate. In the interview with Real America's Voice, the freshman congressman described a high-security area for higher-risk detainees, such as those with serious felony convictions, and a setup of tents for those with lower-level or no criminal offenses on their record. Fryden reported that the base indeed held 23 high-threat illegal aliens and 17 other migrants, but she also reported that none of the 195 tents set up have been used due to not meeting ICE standards, and that the operation to build more tents was halted in February, several weeks after it started. Notably, tent construction also stopped before Hamada visited. To this point in his young congressional career, the 33-year-old Hamada has made more news by what he hasn't said. Despite sitting on the House Committee for Veterans Affairs, Hamada has been largely silent on the Trump administration's cuts to the Veterans Administration. He also has been mum on Donald Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship, which is the kind of citizenship Hamada himself enjoys. This time, instead of keeping himself out of the conversation, Hamada has exposed himself as out of the loop. "Operations are underway as we move forward with securing our homeland and returning dangerous criminals to their own," Hamada's official account tweeted Thursday. Unless their homeland is an immigration detention center in Louisiana, Hamada might want to check his sources. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHoroux and posted on March 14th. Mark Kelly calls Elon Musk an asshole, will ditch his Tesla. For the second time this week, the internet feud between Senator Mark Kelly and Elon Musk has escalated. Last week, Musk labeled the Arizona Democrat a traitor for visiting Ukraine. On Friday, Kelly posted a video to X, the social media site owned by Musk, saying that he was taking his last ride in the Tesla he owns. "Elon Musk kind of turned out to be an asshole," Kelly said in the video. I don't want to be driving a car built and designed by an asshole. Spokesperson Jacob Peters and Kelly's office did not respond to an inquiry from Phoenix New Times about whether the car has been sold or what other types of vehicles Kelly is looking to buy. Kelly, known for his proclivity for bipartisan collaboration and aversion to verbal combat, has embraced a new no-fucks-given tone regarding Musk. The former astronaut and Navy fighter pilot has made his disdain for the unelected billionaire and real-life deep state shadow president, who is dismantling the federal government. When Musk called Kelly a traitor, Kelly clapped back, "Elon, if you don't understand that defending freedom is a basic tenet of what makes America great and keeps us safe, maybe you should leave it to those of us who do," the former astronaut wrote on X. In February, Kelly jumped into a social media back and forth between Musk and two other astronauts, including his twin brother, Scott. "Hey, at Elon Musk," Kelly wrote, "when you finally get the nerve to jump into a rocket ship, come talk to the three of us." Kelly's latest barb is further evidence of Musk's toxic association with the Tesla brand. Musk's roughshod wrecking of federal agencies via his Department of Government Efficiency has been tremendously unpopular and sparked backlash against the car company and its fans. Tesla's stock has taken a huge hit since Trump took office, down about 34% since the beginning of the year. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump did his biggest campaign donor a favor by conducting a garish Tesla commercial in front of the White House, which was about as brazen a display of corruption as any in American history. Notably, not in small part due to contracts with the federal government, many of Musk's other companies have been doing well. That's created the perception that owning a Tesla means co-signing for Musk and Trump's bricking of the federal government. And Kelly seems to have concluded that if you want to lob bombs at Musk for screwing over Americans, you probably shouldn't drive the guy's cars. "When I bought this thing, I didn't think it was going to become a political issue," Kelly said in the video. "Every time I get in this car in the last 60 days or so, it reminds me of just how much damage Elon Musk and Donald Trump are doing to our country." A giant. Arizona politicians react to the death of Representative Raul Grijalva. This next story was written by T.J. LaHarue and posted on March 13th. Representative Raul Grijalva died on Thursday at 77, ending a run of more than two decades spent representing Tucson, or El Pueblo, as he would say, in the U.S. House of Representatives. He died of complications from his treatment for lung cancer. Grijalva was essentially the elder statesman of the Arizona delegation, a uniquely personable, pleasant man who made well with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. Representative Grijalva fought a long and brave battle. He passed away this morning due to complications of his cancer treatments. More than two decades ago, Representative Grijalva embarked on a journey to be a voice for Southern Arizonans in Washington, D.C. Reads a statement written by the congressman's staff. Driven by his community values and spirit, he worked tirelessly and accomplished so much for Arizonans and the country. The son of a migrant worker who was part of the Bracero program that brought more temporary laborers legally to the United States, Grijalva became involved in politics in the late 1960s and early 1970s, a moment of political epiphany for Chicanos and Mexican Americans. He became the Arizona leader of the Raza Unida Party, which was founded in 1970 and dissolved in 1978. After losing a 1972 school board race, he reshaped the passionate and militant radicalism that alienated him from some voters into a more agreeable, smoother style. He served in elected and public roles for decades, including on the Pima County Board of Supervisors from 1989 to 2002. Grijalva was first elected to the House in 2002 and died as the top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee, a role he held since 2015. For 4 years, he was the committee's chair. He was heavily involved in Democratic politics in D.C. and was known to many as a mentor for a generation of leaders. He was also the longest-serving co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus from 2009 to 2019. Grijalva's district has been redrawn since he began his time in Congress, but it currently spans much of southern Arizona. Yuma in the west to Tucson in the east, down south to Bisbee and Douglas, then back up north to Tolleson and Avondale. Here's how Arizona politicians reacted to Grijalva's death. Governor Katie Hobbs, Democrat. "I am devastated by the loss of Representative Raul Grijalva, and my heart is with his family and loved ones. To his last day, he remained a servant leader who put everyday people first while in office. I will join every Arizonan in mourning his passing." Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat. "Congressman Grijalva was not just my colleague, but my friend. As another Latino working in public service, I can say from experience that he served as a role model to many young people across the Grand Canyon State. He spent his life as a voice for equality." Representative Yasemin Ansari, Democrat. "I'm devastated to hear of the passing of my colleague Raul Grijalva. He was a fighter for Arizonans and a champion for indigenous communities and our planet. We will all miss him dearly. My thoughts are with his family, friends, loved ones, and constituents." Representative Greg Stanton, Democrat. "Congressman Raul Grijalva will be rightly remembered as one of the most consequential leaders in Arizona political history. He dedicated his life to serving the community he loved as a political organizer, school board member, and county supervisor before running for Congress, where he faithfully served the people of southern Arizona for more than 20 years. For more than half a decade, Raul served as the top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee, where he fought to protect our public lands, including permanently protecting the Grand Canyon, working to protect Arizona's precious water resources, and led the passage of the Drought Contingency Plan, and was always a steadfast champion for Arizona's tribal nations. Raul never lost sight of the values he learned as a young community organizer, tirelessly advocating for immigrant families, education, and social justice. But perhaps his biggest accomplishment is his mentorship of generations of young people in southern Arizona. I send my deepest condolences to his wife Ramona, 3 daughters, Adelita, Marisa, and Raquel, 5 grandchildren, staff, and the countless lives he touched." Representative Andy Biggs, Republican. "Arizona lost a friend today. Congressman Raul Grijalva was a dedicated public servant who served his constituents well. Cindy and I are thinking of Raul's loved ones and praying for peace and comfort for this time." Representative David Schweikert, Republican. "The congressman was always very kind to me. He had a great sense of humor. As a fellow animal lover, we often found ourselves working together on animal protection issues." To his daughters, Adelita, Raquel, and Marisa, and his wife Ramona, I send my deepest condolences. Representative Abe Hamada, Republican. "Our thoughts are with the family of Representative Raul Grijalva. He was a man who left an indelible mark on southern Arizona. May his memory be a blessing." Representative Eli Crane, Republican. "Rest in peace, sir." Representative Juan Siscomani, Republican. "Arizonans lost a dedicated public servant. Raul was a fearless champion of the causes he believed in, and he never forgot where he came from. While we often disagreed about public policy, he welcomed me into our congressional delegation warmly and always treated me well. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, Democrat. Arizona lost a giant today. Congressman Raul Grijalva dedicated his life to fighting for the people of Arizona. From standing up for working families, indigenous communities, and clean air and water, Raul leaves a legacy that is unmatched. I am thinking of his family and loved ones. Mayor Kate Gallego. I am saddened by Representative Raul Grijalva's passing. He was a fierce advocate for his constituents, a defender of our natural resources, and a champion for climate action. His passing leaves a void in Arizona and beyond. My condolences to his family and friends. Former Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Independent. Today, Arizona lost a champion. Raul Grijalva served Southern Arizona for decades. He fought for the rights and well-being of all Arizonans, especially those who needed a hand. He led the charge to protect our environment and the Grand Canyon for future generations. Former Representative Gabby Giffords, Democrat. Mark and I were devastated to learn that our longtime friend Raul Grijalva passed away. Raul was also a mentor to me when I was first elected to Congress, and Raul showed me the ropes throughout the years and after I was shot. His friendship and wisdom were a constant source of support. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, Democrat. Rest in peace, Congressman Raul Grijalva. Your tireless dedication and unwavering advocacy for Southern Arizona leaves behind an enduring legacy for generations to come. Next, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times, written by Chris Copeland and posted on March 13th. Sound Mind, the case for music therapy in Trump's America. The cavernous auditorium at Central High School in Phoenix crackled with a mix of desperation and nascent rebellion on a crisp Wednesday, before a stage usually reserved for choir concerts and amateur John Steinbeck plays. Several dozen people turned out to see Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays convene a panel unlike any in the school's recent memory. Heartbreaking phone calls and emails have been pouring into my office over the past month, Mays said. Her voice was steady and stern, and she'd pump her fist for emphasis. Also on the panel were three other attorneys general, Don Rayfield of Oregon, Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and Raul Torres of New Mexico, sharing their own encounters with despondent constituents. A look around the auditorium at the people wedged into cheap, bounceless chairs was a glimpse at everyday Phoenix activated. A handsome doctor in a lab coat pored over notes. Young Mexican activists shared their stories of injustice with white women dressed in blazers. Videographers lined the back walls, recording this scorching tinderbox in real time. America is only halfway through Trump's first 100 days, and already gatherings such as this, in which the top law enforcement officials from four states are meeting up in our pivotal purple state, show the urgency of the public's fears. True to his word on the campaign trail, Trump has governed as a chaos agent. He has antagonized NATO, abandoned Ukraine, embraced Vladimir Putin, crippled the IRS and Securities and Exchange Commission, started trade wars with our closest trading partners, and installed a pugnacious Fox News host to run the Department of Defense. Reform should be done lawfully, says Mays, through the constitutional processes that exist for that very purpose, not through unilateral decisions that upend the livelihoods of hardworking Americans, throw entire communities into chaos, or violate the privacy of American citizens. Trump also put the world's purported richest man, Elon Musk, in charge of reshaping the federal government through madcap cuts to the federal workforce. Musk and his quasi-agency DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, have blitzed workers who serve the public at large, slashing weather forecasters, air traffic controllers, and national park rangers. Musk has also fired workers who care for the most vulnerable among us and frozen federal money for programs that will be lost without it. In the high school auditorium, Arizonans hit by these cuts shared their stories with one another and with the attorneys general. A public health activist recounted having to lay off three employees. An OBGYN described helping patients stockpile hormones. A conservationist explained the dangers now facing understaffed national parks. Then Kristen Frey rose to greet the room. She, too, is no elected official. For the past 10 months of her 19-year career, the music therapist had worked at the Carl T. Hayden Veterans Administration Hospital in Phoenix. There, her work supported the mental and emotional health of veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, after effects of Agent Orange exposure, and other maladies. Then, in February, DOGE and Trump slashed some 1,400 VA jobs nationwide, with many more cuts promised. Music therapy was among the casualties. "This was my dream job, and it took 20 years to achieve," Frey told the crowd. "I was terminated immediately. That meant that not only could veterans no longer access the services I provided, but I could not follow my own code of ethics, providing termination services to the veterans. These veterans, some of whom are very fragile, were unable to have that closure, which puts them at risk for depression, anxiety, or even suicidal ideation." It's not clear whether the notions of shame or service resonate in the executive branch right now, but on the chance that we can come back from this moment when PTSD treatments for Iraq war veterans are regarded as government waste, we should talk about music therapy and what it means to people. Arizona's music therapists have always done more than the public realizes to help patients who could otherwise be unreachable. Neither these exceptional therapists nor the patients who reinvent their lives with the use of music therapy deserve to be left behind. Kind of a voodoo scientist. The most generous view of the Trump administration's cuts to music therapy is simply that they do not know what they do. Even people who become music therapists, several of whom participated in this story, didn't understand music therapy's scope before they began their work in the field. "People think we're kind of a voodoo scientist," says Maria Chase Young, a music therapist at ACCEL, an educational nonprofit that serves adults and kids at 9 campuses around Arizona. "But we're trying to change that." Music is, at its core, a form of nonverbal communication, and as such, it can cross boundaries where words alone may fail. The grandfather of music therapy in the United States was a University of Kansas psychologist named E. Thayer Gaston, who after World War II worked with veterans experiencing shell shock, what we'd now call PTSD. He was a pioneer in a field aimed at healing the brain and the self. At the time, Chase Young says, music therapy was seen as a way to lift spirits and make people happy and healthy in mind, body, and soul. That is, not that much more than music. Yet, as Thayer and other practitioners developed the field in the 1960s and beyond, they began to unlock more benefits. Charlotte Stewart, a music therapist and founder of Mellow Music Therapy, a practice in Mesa that treats adults with a range of neurological conditions, says the field evolved from its origins in recreation to a more robust clinical view of patients. When she designs a treatment plan, Stewart first considers her patient's ability to function physically, emotionally, and cognitively. She then designs music interventions to address some goals in those areas. Music, Stewart says, is the prescription. That breadth of considerations regularly produces a more varied treatment approach, often a cocktail of speech and physical therapy with a dash of psychotherapy. Individual patients are just as varied. Music therapists treat children with autism or developmental delays, people with schizophrenia, people recovering from strokes, people who have survived abuse or injury, and people seeking palliative care. A therapy plan may involve various disciplines and approaches, but often it boils down to using music to reach afflicted patients to accomplish non-music-related goals. Stewart, for instance, previously helped a stroke victim by using his favorite songs to manage a depressive state after the patient suffered a significant loss in communication skills. Kelly Kwok, a music therapist at ACCEL in Glendale, meanwhile, says that she uses lesson-oriented music therapy to address a student's needs. Suzanne Oliver, a music therapist at Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona in Phoenix, works primarily with autistic people and uses music to help them overcome frontal sway loops, where they do repetitive things over and over again, she says. If there's a need, music therapy has an approach to empower patients. An average session is establishing rapport with the person and assessing where they're at, Oliver says. It's how I shape music exercises and music experiences that'll create a brain change in that session, but then also long term. She and other therapists say they grapple with the rapid mainstreaming of music therapy. A couple decades ago, Oliver says, she had to leave Arizona to pursue music therapy because there were simply no available jobs. Today, Arizona State and University of Arizona both offer undergraduate degrees in music therapy, among 70 college programs nationwide, approved by the American Music Therapy Association. As of 2024, the Certification Board for Music Therapists counts 10,511 board-certified music therapists across the United States, double the total of just 13 years ago. These professionals are finding ample evidence that music therapy works. A 2022 meta-analysis of 47 music therapy studies, published in Health Psychology Review, found that they showed consistent medium to large beneficial effect on stress. Similarly, a 2017 systematic review from Pain Physician Journal of 1,178 participants showed that music therapy reduced self-reported chronic pain and associated depressive symptoms. The proof is there. You just have to look for it. Everything is about music now. Lenny Henderson is one person for whom music therapy's benefits are beyond theoretical. For the former helicopter medic, music has always been a companion. You'd often find him playing a harmonica he's had for decades. But when he suffered a debilitating stroke several years ago, he struggled with loss of speech, of memory, and of emotional control. Music therapy helped him to recover his very life. I was blessed by God once more to be able to read, write, ride a bicycle, and do many things as before, he wrote via email. His hobbies now include crafting cigar box musical instruments, his way of paying music forward. Dozens of other families around Phoenix have stories like Henderson's. Many parents have seen their lives change as their young children succeeded through music therapy. Before music therapy, Jim and Shelley Dilbeck say that their son, J.J. Dilbeck, was nearly kicked out of school for his aggressive behavior. After therapy, their son is less prone to lashing out and seems more peaceful. He now has hope that music might become a potential career path for her son. "I see him take more interest in music," Shelley Dilbeck says. "I also see that he wants to do more. His behaviors have been really good as well, especially if it's all about music. He gets up in the morning to music, and he goes to sleep with music." Lily Robles, meanwhile, was unaware of music therapy, even after her own sister expressed interest in a local program. But her daughter, Abby Robles, eventually enrolled in ACCEL's program to deal with deficits in her communication and motor skills. While the child still experiences setbacks, there's a larger success to celebrate. "I've seen how she's made progress with it, and it's definitely given her more self-confidence," Lily Robles says. She wants to explore different sides of music and sounds and instruments. She writes songs for her siblings now. "We have 5 kiddos in the house, and everything is about music now." Other children, such as Jonah Miller, use music therapy to access music itself. His parents, Gina and A.J. Miller, noticed him picking out harmonies on the piano when he was just a toddler. Over time, however, he came to use the piano to pound out his frustrations, bashing keys until they broke. Music therapy brought him back around to playing with joy, giving his parents a chance to connect with him. "He is much more interactive," Gina Miller says. "He understands more of what you're asking. It's helping to reintroduce his love of music." Results will vary among the kids and adults who try music therapy. Some will take to it like a wren to a ditty. Others will find that it isn't a panacea. But to cite one final example, there's absolutely life-changing power in music. Not long after Gabby Giffords survived a gunshot to the head, the former U.S. representative enrolled in music therapy. In a November 2011 interview with ABC, Giffords' musical therapist, Megan Morrow, recounted that Giffords went from humming "Brown Eyed Girl" and "American Pie" to singing these songs outright in a few weeks. "When I first saw Gabby, and I first sang the song with her," Morrow said at the time, "I knew that things were going to get better." The music actually drives the change. Despite the everyday and high-profile wins for their profession, therapists still spend copious time explaining the basic aspects of their practices. Sometimes people simply confuse music therapy with music lessons. As Stewart explains, "We're focusing on what the music is going to do for you, and then as a bonus, we get music out of it." Other times, though, this lack of understanding surfaces as misinformation. Therapists have found that people think that they can act as their own musical therapist. When people lack clinical know-how, a DIY approach can have unpleasant consequences. Songs are tied inextricably to memories, both specific and general. This idea of just popping headsets on people, if you haven't really looked up the music, you can trigger a negative reaction, Oliver says. A song that was merely popular during a traumatic time could thus be a landmine, or a well-meaning gesture could be merely a gesture. It can be nice to play the harp when someone's dying, but YouTube needs to stop calling that music therapy, Kwok says. In 13 states, you have to have licenses. With neurologic music therapy, there's 29 standardized approaches, and they're all coming from a results-driven approach. Musical therapists consider many layers of meaning for the approaches that they bring to different treatments. With their training in neuroscience, Oliver says, therapists engage music's specific effects on a person's brain. A sing-along in a retirement home, for instance, may seem like fun to the participants, while the therapist is trying to optimize the neurological benefits. Some music therapists use music in therapy, Oliver says. As neurologic music therapists, we use music as therapy. The music actually drives the change versus the music supporting somebody emotionally or recreationally. There's nothing wrong with using music to aid in recovery and whatnot. Every person who enjoys music uses it to some extent as a mood regulator. But patients must recognize the difference between self-help and actual therapy. In the latter, patients get support they're incapable of providing for themselves. On that last point, Henderson has something to say. During the course of his ongoing music therapy journey, the former pilot has worked with Stewart to craft a song that addresses his experience and encapsulates music therapy's real-world effects. One quietly heartbreaking line from Lenny's Blues in A speaks to how music can help overcome chasms of disconnect. "I'm blue with a song I can't sing, and I wrote it," Henderson wrote. "I'm blue with a song I can't sing, and I wrote it. The chords are hard, so is the tune." The honor of experiencing art. A day after the community meeting at Central High, I caught up with Frey, just as she was coming off a job interview, no less. She said she remains cautiously optimistic about landing a music therapy gig at a private hospital. That's not to undercut her dignity-siphoning dismissal. She got the news of that capricious cut as she was at home caring for her husband, who's recovering from surgery. Even if she can get reinstated at the VA, Frey might not return with the same parameters and freedoms. Yet, she wasn't nearly as worried about the job search as she was for her former patients. She mentioned some who had started their own therapy group around a Spotify playlist. The one that seems to resonate loudest was a patient she met as he was dying in hospice. In a darkened room, with so much life buzzing on the periphery, she picked up her guitar and played for him a beloved Bob Dylan tune. Her soothing, nearly serene tone worked its way through new lyrics about peace and letting go. Each new note grew shorter, as though she was drawing the man's breath down to a slow, steady pace. Then, in an instant, he was gone. With the last notes, the room fell quiet. "It was an honor," Frey said, with awe in her voice. "Art helped make us. It's part of the human experience." Music therapy helps people get through their life. It connects hearts and literally changes minds. It empowers people to dismantle hardships, find strength, build joy, and fully embrace their humanity. The lessons that music therapists provide are ones we desperately need now. Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on March 12th. Department of Gaming shares huge betting totals. Notes it's Problem Gambling Awareness Month. Arizonans love to bet on sports. Also, put on concerned face, March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. That tonal whiplash was featured in an Arizona Department of Gaming press release issued Tuesday. In one breath, the department shared the latest sports betting figures. In December 2024, Arizona sports bettors wagered a whopping $849 million, a 23% increase from the year prior. That's not quite a record, but it's close. The month before, bettors wagered a record-breaking $897 million. For all of 2024, almost $8 billion was wagered in Arizona. In the next breath, the department offered a public service announcement. Tuesday was Gambling Disorder Screening Day, and March is the month for problem gambling awareness. The release quoted Governor Katie Hobbs as saying that problem gambling is a serious issue that impacts thousands of Arizonans. In 2024, the Department of Gaming connected almost 1,000 people with problem gambling treatment. Its Division of Problem Gambling also has a free confidential helpline, 1-800-NEXT-STEP, or 1-800-639-8783, and online resources to help people with their gambling problems. "We want every Arizonan to know they are not alone," added Elise Mickelson, director of the Division of Problem Gambling. "Yeah, we know. We've seen the numbers." Online sports gambling has been legal in Arizona since late 2021, when Governor Doug Ducey signed a law opening the state to sportsbooks. In 2022, almost $6 billion was wagered in Arizona, according to Department of Gaming data. Since then, the amount of money wagered through the sports betting law has increased by 34%. And almost all, more than 99% of this wagering is done on mobile apps such as FanDuel, BetMGM, and DraftKings. FanDuel seems to be Arizonans' favorite sports betting app, with $275 million spent on the app alone in March, or rather in December of 2024. Arizonans don't seem to be that great at it, though. Sportsbooks paid out $798 million to bettors in December, roughly $50 million less than they wagered. They say that the house always wins, and that was true for every month of 2024. Not once did bettors win more than they wagered. Despite the huge numbers, Arizona taxpayers don't actually see much benefit from sports betting. Sportsbooks pay an 8% tax on in-person bets and a 10% tax on mobile bets. But because of carve-outs for so-called free bets that sportsbooks offer as a marketing tactic, Arizona netted only $2.6 million in privilege fees in December. Arizona passed the abortion amendment. Getting one is still too hard. The program continues now with this story by Morgan Fisher, posted on the Phoenix New Times website on March 12th. Late on a recent afternoon, Dr. Deshaun Taylor dropped into a black office chair. Letting out a large sigh, she wanted to steal a moment to rest. Her workday is over, but there is more to do. Sporting purple scrubs and a matching bob, Taylor is always busy. She's an OBGYN who runs the Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix, which offers abortions and other types of reproductive care. She's also an activist. She advocated for Proposition 139. A ballot measure enshrining a right to abortion in the Arizona Constitution. And she then worked to convince voters to pass it. Pass it they did. Reproductive rights are popular in Arizona, with 61% of voters opting to write them into the state's constitution last fall. The ballot initiative was more popular among Arizonans than the winner of the presidential election. The amendment gained 230,045 more votes in the state than Donald Trump. That victory signaled the end of Arizona's pre-existing 15-week ban on abortion, which was finally invalidated by a judge earlier this month. Yet, for Taylor and other abortion providers in Arizona, not much else has changed. They can perform abortions up to fetal viability, roughly 23 or 24 weeks, but a maze of other restrictions persist. The 15-week ban was only one of roughly 40 anti-abortion statutes on the books in Arizona. The rest of those laws continue to do their intended purpose: make abortions harder to get. Abortion providers and activists have tried to get those laws repealed by the Arizona legislature, but the going is tough. Anti-abortion Republicans hold majorities in both chambers. As she sips a cup of coffee, Taylor opens her laptop to check on the effort. Her organization, the Arizona Proactive Reproductive Justice Alliance, is pushing a bill that would handle the problem in one fell swoop. Senate Bill 1553, sponsored by Democratic State Senator Annalise Ortiz, would repeal nearly every abortion restriction in the Arizona revised statutes. The state's 24-hour waiting period and telehealth ban, which require two in-person appointments before patients can get an abortion, would be gone. So would the prohibition on nurse practitioners providing medical abortions and reading required state-created scripts. Abortions would be allowed when the fetus has a genetic abnormality. "Wait," Dr. Taylor says with surprise, scrolling slowly the legislature's bill tracker page. "It got a hearing." That's all it got. Ortiz's bill never escaped committee, meaning it would never get an up or down vote in the Senate. If it had, the vote likely would have been down. The Republican-controlled legislature has yet to let a pro-abortion bill make it to the floor. Meanwhile, GOP lawmakers have pushed several bills that would restrict abortion further. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs will stop those anti-abortion measures from becoming law, but abortion advocates such as Taylor will have to rely on court battles to whittle down the laws currently in effect. That process will be long. Proposition 139 forced a change, a big one to be sure, but only one. Every day, abortion providers jump through hoops and clear hurdles to give women the reproductive care the state constitution now says is their right. Anti-abortion sentiment, said Taylor, is baked into every part of our system. A web of restrictions. Taylor opened her clinic in 2013. She has never known an Arizona without restrictive abortion laws. That was the case prior to the fall of Roe v. Wade in 2022, and it's the case now that the state's 15-week ban has been overturned. Even after Proposition 139, abortion in Arizona isn't as rosy a picture as I think a lot of people want it to be, said Dr. Misha Pangasa, an abortion provider and OBGYN at Planned Parenthood Arizona. There are still arbitrary obstacles that our patients have to jump through in order to get the abortion care that they need and have decided on. The Guttmacher Institute still identifies Arizona as a restrictive state on abortion due to the sheer number of restrictions still on the books. Many of those were passed under the guise of patient safety, said Dr. Gabriel Goodrick, the medical director and founder of Camelback Family Planning. But they do not improve patient safety. They're burdensome and unnecessary. Goodrick, who founded her clinic in 1999, considers the 24-hour waiting period restrictions one of the worst. "Some patients may need the extra time to think through their decision," Pangasa said, "but many abortion patients already have their minds made up. Many are already mothers and have busy schedules." Both appointments, the first to request an abortion, the second to actually have it, must be conducted in person because the state bans telemedicine for abortion. Many patients have a hard time getting one day off work, much less two. Often, patients can't get that second appointment until 1 or 2 weeks later. Depending on where you live in the Grand Canyon state, obtaining abortion care could mean hundreds of miles on the road and multiple motel stays. There are 9 abortion clinics in the state, according to Abortion Finder and Planned Parenthood, 6 in the Valley, 2 in Tucson, and 1 in Flagstaff. if someone in Page wanted an abortion, the closest clinic would be Planned Parenthood's Flagstaff location, which is 2 hours away. Round trips for both state-mandated appointments would require 8 hours in the car. The Flagstaff clinic is equipped only to provide medication abortions. If the patient is past 12 weeks, a trip to the organization's Glendale clinic would be required. 8 hours in the car has now become 16. This tactic to delay care just pushes people to have to wait longer and drive further, Pangasa said. Legislators have also increasingly restricted who can provide abortion care. Only physicians, not nurse practitioners or other medical staff, can provide surgical or medication abortions or read the state-created script that pushes abortion alternatives. At Taylor's clinic, she has to sit down with every patient to read the script and hand over a pill. If a nurse practitioner or another staffer could do this instead, Taylor could see many more patients who need her attention. OBGYNs, like Taylor, have other obstacles to surmount. Abortion providers must have hospital admitting privileges within 30 miles of the clinic. But obtaining admitting privileges can be tough. Providers must prove to hospitals that a certain number of their patients will be admitted for care at the hospital. With few abortion-related complications these days, it can be difficult to reach that number. It's like a catch-22, Goodrich said. When she moved to Arizona, Taylor obtained admitting privileges by showing her caseload from California, where she had a full OBGYN practice. She's been able to renew each year by establishing an understanding with the local hospitals. She does not deliver babies as part of her clinic work, and in her 16 years of providing care in Arizona, she's had perhaps 5 patients require hospitalization, she said. What happens down here in Phoenix is we have progressive faculty in hospitals that understand the assignment, Taylor said. They understand the political climate, and I have an agreement. Other restrictions, such as a requirement for parental consent, are so burdensome that Goodrich's clinic has a pro bono lawyer on call to help minors, many of whom are in the foster system. That attorney helps teens obtain a judicial bypass, which can be a scary and confusing process. One of Goodrich's staffers is a notary public, who can notarize parental permission slips, sparing teen patients a cumbersome errand. All of these restrictions make providers' and patients' lives more difficult. They also create this idea that somehow abortion providers aren't safe, Taylor said, which puts up that barrier for patients to make them think that they're doing something that's dangerous. And if getting an abortion in Arizona is hard, knocking abortion restrictions off the books is even harder. Long road ahead. Theoretically, the process of invalidating Arizona's abortion laws should be simple. The voters clearly supported fewer restrictions. The right to an abortion is written in black and white in the state constitution. Clearly, state lawmakers would vote to align Arizona laws with voters' intent. Nope. In the first legislative session since Proposition 139 passed, state Democrats have introduced 10 bills to repeal anti-abortion restrictions. They aim to repeal the bans on telemedicine appointments, the mailing of abortion pills, and abortion advertising, among others. These bills would also get rid of abortion reporting requirements, certain clinic regulations, the 24-hour waiting period, and parental consent requirements. They've gone nowhere. Republicans have a majority at the Capitol and can decide which bills get heard and which don't. Only a few restriction-loosening bills have been assigned to committees. None have advanced to a floor vote. It's a continuation of the same old partisan way that Republicans in the legislature have governed, said Democratic State Senator Priya Sundarajan. Republican lawmakers have also pushed bills to further restrict abortion. 7 anti-abortion bills have been introduced this session. They would further restrict access to abortion pills and cut funding for abortion-providing health centers, provide parental access to medical records, and promote anti-abortion material on state websites. This is a slap in the face of the voters. Former state lawmaker and current abortion rights activist Athena Solomon said during a press conference at the Arizona Capitol on March 5th. Those bills are also doomed. No matter how much support they get in the legislature, Hobbs will veto them. But Hobbs can't do anything about the anti-abortion laws that are already in place, and Democrats can't do anything to knock them down in the legislature. Abortion was more popular than any candidate during the November election, so we see that as a mandate, Taylor said. We have clean bills that we can continue to introduce until the conditions are favorable for them to actually pass. Until that day arrives, she'll continue to spend days on her feet scurrying between patients seeking reproductive care. When the last patient leaves, she'll return to her office, pour another cup of coffee, and open the laptop covered in abortion rights stickers. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.